Class is back in session. It's time for Baptist Basics University from BaptistBasics.org. Welcome back to Baptist Basics University, another long overdue episode of Baptist Basics University. I'm Matthew Gage, and this is lesson number 3 in our series going through the book of Daniel. And today we'll be in chapter number 2 and looking at the great image. Now, I apologize. I got started, got the first couple lessons out, and just the time of the year, every time it gets around October, November, seasons start changing, the cold weather starts coming in, I usually start having allergy problems and different things, and lost my voice, or at least was having vocal problems with allergies and stuff for a couple weeks. Really didn't want to record and have y'all to suffer listening to me barely being able to talk or, struggling. So, and then just normal life gets in the way, and it's a little hard to find time, quiet time to sit at the computer and record. So I'm running a little bit behind from where I am. In fact, I think I'm actually like three or four lessons ahead of this. I just did chapter 5. So, this previous Sunday. So run a little bit behind from where I've been doing these, in Sunday school, but nevertheless got some time. So I'm going to try to make it through chapter 2 in this recording. I'm going to have my doubts that I make it through this one in one setting. I'm not sure how much time I have. My wife's at the store. So we're just going to hurry through this and try to do it justice. Daniel chapter 2 is an important chapter in the Bible, in prophecy, and it has themes that are going to be revisited later on when we get to the second half of Daniel. There's a lot of major things and major themes and major people and major ideas involved in this chapter. We see, the great King Nebuchadnezzar. We see, we get an outline of history of four major kingdoms that begin with Babylon under Nebuchadnezzar. And so we have an outline of history that will be revisited later. We have, we're introduced to, Daniel's ability to interpret dreams and Daniel's interaction with prophecy, so which is a major theme throughout the book. So there's a lot of major things we're introduced to now that we really get into Daniel's life and works. Chapter 1, basically introduces us to who he is. We get a glimpse of the man, of his integrity, of his character. And now we're really going to see him at work and God using him in chapter number 2. So let's let me make sure we got everything covered here. Okay, let's go ahead and we'll get started going through Daniel chapter 2. Daniel chapter 2 and verse 1, and I'm reading from a new Bible, so I apologize if I stumble a little bit. Get a new Bible and sometimes it's a little difficult. You're not used to the text and printing and stuff. And let me say, I highly recommend the R.L. Allen Bibles. The binding company in Scotland, they're very expensive, but oh my goodness, this is like the best Bible I've ever had. So, loving it. I only had it about a week. Daniel chapter 2 and verse 1. And in the second year of the reign of Nebuchadnezzar, Nebuchadnezzar dreamed dreams wherewith his spirit was troubled and his sleep break from him. First thing I want to point out is that it says that this is the second year of the reign of Nebuchadnezzar. This is the second year of Nebuchadnezzar's sole reign. The first part of, like in Daniel chapter 1, the first part of Nebuchadnezzar's reign, he was actually under his father. So this is really where he is. He's now the king. His father's passed away, and he is now the king and the ruler. This is the second year of his sole reign. So what this correlates to is to the end of chapter 1. So chapter 2 follows just days, months, pretty sure it's going to be less than a year after the events at the end of chapter 1. So that'll give you some time frame going on as to where this will take place kind of in the outline of history. But this is taking place. I mean, Nebuchadnezzar hasn't been king very long, and and this takes place very soon after the end of chapter one. Now, Nebuchadnezzar has dreamed a dream, and this dream troubles him. I don't know if you've ever had a bad dream. Every now and then I'll have a dream that'll upset me, you know, because of the, the turmoil or something happening in it, you know, a nightmare type thing. And, you wake up in the morning and you wake up from the dream and you're sweating and your heart's pounding and you're just on edge. Your adrenaline's flowing. I mean, you're just worked up because of this dream. Well, Nebuchadnezzar has one of those, multiplied in its intensity. And he wakes up from this dream and this dream scares him to death. It worries him. And when you read the dream, or when we get to the actual dream, when we find out what it was, you're like, really, that scared me? You know, I've had way worse dreams than that, you know, about giant spiders or, you know, different things like that. But for whatever reason, this dream just really gets to the king. Verse number two. Then the king commanded to call the magicians and the astrologers and the sorcerers and the Chaldeans for to show the king his dreams. So they came and stood before the king. So he calls all the usual suspects, all the smart people in the kingdom. And that's who these people are mainly. The magicians are really like scientists kind of people. Astrologers, those are the people that would get in studying the movement of the stars. We talked a little bit about that, I believe, in the previous lesson, some of the stuff that they studied. But also into the astrology, like we think of interpreting future and things by studying the stars. Sorcerers gets into, I believe, if I remember right, and I didn't really get too in depth any of this when I did this in Sunday school, so I'm riffing off the top of my head here. But sorcerers, I believe that's talking about people that would do, you know, incantations. They would have their little things that they would do. The Chaldeans is that that class or caste of the intelligentsia, the elite of the Babylonians. So you know, he's called in all the people who should be able, the best and the brightest, to come in, people who are used to dealing with this kind of thing, of interpreting dreams and things like that. He calls them all in for an answer. Verse number three. And the king said unto them, I have dreamed a dream, and my spirit was troubled to know the dream. So just lays it out and said, look, hey, I'm upset, had a dream, it's bothering me. So verse 4. Then spake the Chaldeans to the king in Syriac, O king, live forever. Tell thy servants the dream, and we will show the interpretation. So like, okay, hey, you know, we've been here before. This is probably the first time he's called them in for something like this. So it's pretty routine. So it's like, hey, you know, sure, we'll tell you what the dream means. You know, I've seen stuff, you know, articles on the internet, what your dreams say about you. You know, if you have the dream that you go to work and you forget to wear your shirt or something like that, you know, that you lack self-confidence, you know, even today people are fascinated by this kind of stuff. But the first request they make is a simple one. It's like, okay, you want the dream interpreted? Well, just tell us what the dream is. Verse 5, the king answered and said to the Chaldeans, the thing is gone from me. If you will not make known unto me the dream with the interpretation thereof, ye shall be cut in pieces, and your houses shall be made a dunghill. So he says, okay, fellas, you want to know the dream? There's a little problem. I don't know the dream, but it was bad, and it really upset me. So if you can't solve this problem, if you can't make me feel better, there's going to be consequences. We're going to be cut in pieces. We're going to butcher you people. And the house is being made a dunghill. We're going to turn your house into your estate into a garbage dump or a manure pile. Sticking with the language there. I mean, so there's going to be some serious consequences if these people cannot tell him the dream he doesn't know. Verse 6, but if ye show the dream and the interpretation thereof, ye shall receive of me gifts and rewards and great honor. Therefore, show me the dream and the interpretation thereof. So, okay, well, guys, I'm not such a bad person. You know, there's a way to get out of this. In fact, you know, if you don't tell me, we're going to chop you up and turn your house into a manure pile. But if you do tell me, hey, I'm going to reward you and it'll be great. So verse 7, they answered again and said, let the king tell his servants the dream, and we will show the interpretation of it. So I can imagine they kind of huddle up together and like, okay, well, this is weird. We've never been asked to do this before. What do we do? So let's just kind of ask again. You know, maybe we'll pry a little bit. you know, this is classic stuff when you're dealing with fortune tellers and different things. What they will do is they'll bait you for information and then make assumptions on that to give you your quote unquote fortune. You know, they'll look down, see your wedding ring or something, and say, "Oh, you must be a married man. Well, you know, I see in your future a happily married life." And, you know, there's little tricks like that. It's not magic. A lot of it's just trickery and using a whole lot of logic and deductive reasoning and stuff. But, you know, I think maybe they're trying to do that. Well, you know, we'll just ask the king again. Maybe he'll slip up and tell us something. You know, he'll tell us that he dreamed about a bear or something, and we'll make something up. But, so they ask again. So verse 8, the king answered and said, "I know of certainty that ye would gain the time because ye see the thing is gone from me." So the king says, "All right, I can tell you're stalling. You're just trying to get some time to make up an answer or something." So verse 9, but if ye will not make known unto me the dream, there is but one decree for you, for ye have prepared lying and corrupt words to speak before me till the time be changed. Therefore, tell me the dream, and I shall know that ye can show me the interpretation thereof. So, I mean, he just flat out challenged him. He's like, okay, if you can't answer this question, you're a bunch of frauds. You're no good. There's only one decree. That decree is probably that, you know, they're going to be chopped up and their houses turned into manure piles. But you know, he's once again, he challenged him. He says, "Guys, I'm telling you, I'm the king. You work for me. Tell me what I dreamed." Verse 10, the Chaldeans answered before the king and said, "There is not a man upon the earth that can show the king's matter. Therefore, there is no king, lord, nor ruler that asked such things as at any magician or astrologer or Chaldean." So they get defensive and say, "Look, king, there's nobody in this world that can do this. In fact, everybody knows that this is impossible. They don't even ask us to do this." I mean, this would be like you going to a scientist saying, "Hey, turn this bar of lead into gold." You know, the old alchemy kind of thing. The scientist would laugh at you and say, "Hey, everybody knows now you can't turn lead into gold. And, you know, you don't even ask people to do that anymore because they've determined it's impossible to do." So, but I do like, they do get one thing. Well, there's a couple things to get right in this, but the main thing, it says there's not a man upon the earth. You know, they're right. There is not a man that could answer this. But there is a God, and he can take care of this. Verse 11, "And it is a rare thing that the king requireth, and there is none other that can show it before the king except the gods, whose dwelling is not with flesh." So they even admit, says, "Look, king, you know, what you're asking us, nobody asks for this. And the only person to answer this is in the supernatural realm, a god or something like that. And, you know, we're not gods, we're humans, we can't do this." So verse 12, "For this cause the king was angry and very furious and commanded to destroy all the wise men of Babylon." So, you know, Nebuchadnezzar is really, really ticked off now. And so he sends out the one decree and says, "Okay, let's chop up all the Chaldeans, all the astrologers, all the sorcerers, all the magicians, all those smart people, all the scientists, all the people who are supposed to study the future and know all this stuff. Let's send out the decree. We're going to chop them all up and we'll turn all their houses into dunghills." So now there's a little problem with that, is because if you'll remember, there's four young men who just became part of this system, part of this this cast of people, and that is Daniel, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah. You know, from chapter 1. So verse 13, "And the decree went forth that the wise men should be slain, and they sought Daniel and his fellows to be slain." So the decree went out, it's law, we're going to go out, we're going to kill them all. And it comes down to Daniel, says, "Now, Daniel, it's your turn. We're here to, you know, to arrest you or to get ready to have you killed," whatever. Verse 14, "Then Daniel answered with counsel and wisdom to Arioch, the captain of the king's guard, which was gone forth to slay the wise men of Babylon." So Daniel is able to kind of talk and buy some time, talking to this guy, like it says, with counsel and wisdom. You know, he's not flying off the cuff. He's very deliberate in how he's dealing with this person to get some more time. Just to give you some idea, though, something interesting here. The name Arioch means long or tall, great. You know, so this evidently was a big guy. Captain of the King's Guard. Actually, the word guard literally translated would be executioner. In fact, the word there means butcher. So when the king says we're going to chop people up in pieces, this was the butcher who would take care of that. So verse 15, he answered and said to Arioch, this is Daniel speaking, the king's captain, why is the decree so hasty from the king? Then Arioch made the thing known to Daniel. So Daniel's like, hold on, what's going on? You know, why is this happening so fast? Tell me what's going on. So Arioch explains it all to Daniel, who, you know, was not part of the previous interview. So verse 16, then Daniel went in and desired of the king that he would give him time and that he would show the king the interpretation. So it's kind of interesting. Daniel asked for time and the king gives it to him. The other guys, when they asked for time from the king denied it. Maybe by this time enough time's passed that Nebuchadnezzar has cooled down a little bit and said, okay, you know, hey, what's another day, you know, or whatever's going on. Maybe he just, this is part of the favor that he had, that Daniel has with the king, that that the king would allow him to have a little bit of extra time. Verse 17, then Daniel went to his house and made the thing known to Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah, his companions. So goes home, calls his friends together. And what do they do? Verse 18, that they would desire mercies of the God of heaven concerning this secret, that Daniel and his fellows should not perish with the rest of the wise men of Babylon. So what do? They have a prayer meeting. They get together and start begging God to help them, begging God for this answer to Nebuchadnezzar's dream. Now, I'll tell you, that right there is kind of a challenge. You know, what do we do when we're faced with a problem? You know, so many times, I'm a Texan. We've got the Western heritage. You know, when we face a problem, we want to saddle up and ride. You know, boys, it's time to get the guns and go to town and let's square off with this problem and take care of business. You know, that's the way, a Texan deals with things. And a lot of people work that way. But, you know, when faced with this problem, what does Daniel do? Does he cry? Does he moan? Does he complain? Does he immediately go into the library and start studying? Does he, what does he do? He goes to God in prayer. I think there's something we can learn from that. If someone like Daniel does that, maybe that's what we ought to do. Because, you know, God can take care of problems a lot better than we can. That's something I've had to learn. If you just have the patience and let God deal with things, he can do so much more and such a better job than we ever can. You know, we want to, you know, somebody picking on us, let's drop the gloves and let's duke it out right now. I'll beat you to smithereens and right will prevail. And you know what? God can probably handle a bully a lot better than we can. God can handle a financial crisis a lot better than we can a lot of times. And, you know, I think there is something there that we ought to learn, that we ought to take to heart. When we face a problem, what do? Why not take it to God first? Why not go to him in prayer first? Verse number 19. Then was the secret revealed unto Daniel in the night vision. And Daniel blessed the God of heaven. So the prayers are answered. Daniel has the answer. God has revealed to him Nebuchadnezzar's dream and its interpretation. So what does Daniel do? Daniel rushes to the king, right? No, I like this. Daniel's going to take some time to think and praise God. Verse 20, Daniel answered and said, blessed be the name of God forever and ever, for wisdom and might are his. Verse 21, and he changeth the times and seasons. He removeth kings and setteth up kings. He giveth wisdom unto the wise and knowledge to them that know understanding. Verse 22, he revealeth the deep and secret things. He knoweth what is in the darkness, and the light dwelleth with him. Verse 23, I thank thee and praise thee, O thou God of my fathers, who hast given me wisdom and might, and hast made known unto me now what we desired for thee. For thou hast now made known unto us the king's matter. So what does Daniel do? The first thing he does is stop and just praises God a little bit. I mean, look at how he's lifting him up. And you know, somebody once said, I heard somebody say, you know, when you praise God, that basically you're acknowledging who or what God is. And that's what Daniel's doing. You know, saying, blessed is the name of God forever and ever. Well, of course, it's going to be blessed forever and ever. You know, wisdom and might are his. Yeah, you know, yes, all that stuff comes from God. He changes the times and the seasons, that the world and nature is in his hands. He removeth kings and setteth up kings, that the affairs of men are guided by his hand, that you know he has an active part in the affairs of men, that knowledge and understanding are from him, that he knows the things we cannot know, in verse 22, the deep and secret things, and knoweth what is in the darkness, that beyond our human comprehension is just the scratching the surface of what God knows and understands. And not only does he understand what is, he understands what will be. He understands what could be, and the many possibilities, that God is so far beyond what we know. So, I mean, there's a whole lot there that Daniel's just stopping back and saying, wow, what a great God I serve. And then verse 23, you know, says, I thank thee. He stops to give thanksgiving to God. You know, this is one of the things I think we struggle with too. Not only, you know, do we not stop and pray when we face a problem, a lot of times when God answers that prayer or when God does move, do we stop and take time to thank him for it? I remember reading about a preacher, and I don't know. There's so many of these little legends about different preachers, you know, that it's hard to remember who actually did what. And even if they said Spurgeon did it, he may not. In fact, probably didn't. Everybody thinks Spurgeon did everything. But I heard a story once about a preacher, that young preacher was asking him and kind of interviewing him and asked him about his prayer life. And this older preacher said, well, I pray like 2 or 3 hours, I think it was, before I preach. And the young man was, oh, wow, that's amazing. You know, almost, you know, kind of making notes. And then the older preacher continued, and he says, and I also pray for the same amount after my sermon. And the young man was kind of puzzled and thought, well, why do you pray after you've preached? And he said, well, you see, the old preacher replied, he said, you know, you see, I pray for that time before it, for God's power, for God's wisdom. Then I take that time afterwards to thank God and to praise him for what he did. And, you know, I wonder sometimes if God wouldn't do more for us if we wouldn't take the time to thank him for it. You know, I'm more likely to do things for people who thank me for it. I'm more likely to do things for people who are grateful for things I've done for them, you know. God is not like us. He doesn't have those same type of human emotions. But I can't help but think that those who praise him and those that thank him and give him the honor and give him the glory are not going to open up more answers to prayers, open up more areas in their life for God to move. Let's continue on. Verse 24. Therefore Daniel went in unto Arioch, whom the king had ordained to destroy the wise men of Babylon. He went and said thus unto him, destroy not the wise men of Babylon, bring me in before the king, and I will show unto the king the interpretation. So Daniel goes to the guard, and you know, the butcher that's supposed to slay them, and says, look, I've got the answer. Hold up. Hold everything. Don't kill anybody. I've got the answer. It's verse 25. Then Arioch brought in Daniel before the king in haste, very quickly. That's, you know, and said thus unto him, I have found a man of the captives of Judah that will make known unto the king the interpretation. So Arioch brings him in a hurry. I guess Arioch, even though he's a butcher, and even though he probably enjoys butchering, most people in that situation do. But perhaps he even realizes that what the king's doing isn't very smart here, and I'm just kind of assuming that. But when Daniel comes in and says, "Hey, I've got the answer," Arioch doesn't cover it up. Arioch takes him straight before the king in a hurry. He says, "Let's get this answer. Let's get this settled." Verse 26. The king answered and said unto Daniel, whose name was Belteshazzar, remember that's the pagan name that they gave him, art thou able to make known unto me the dream which I have seen and the interpretation thereof? Verse 27. Daniel answered in the presence of the king and said, the secret which the king hath demanded cannot the wise men and the astrologers, the magicians, the soothsayers show unto the king. So it's like, Daniel says, number one, king, you're hopeless. Nobody can help you with your problem. Verse 28, but there is a God. I have that underlined in my Bible. You know, when anything seems impossible, but there is a God. It really can be the answer to any problem, because God can intervene and do the miraculous. But there is a God. But there is a God in heaven that revealeth secrets and maketh known to the king Nebuchadnezzar what shall be in the latter days. Thy dream and the visions of thy head upon thy bed, I like the rhythm of that, the visions of thy head upon thy bed, are these. Verse 29. As for thee, O king, thy thoughts came into thy mind upon thy bed, what should come to pass hereafter, and he that revealeth secrets maketh known to thee what shall come to pass. So, first off, Daniel's telling him, you know, look, king, what was revealed to you is prophecy, that God has decided to reveal to you what's going to come. Verse 30. But as for me, the secret is not revealed to me for any wisdom that I have more than any living, but for their sakes that shall make known the interpretation to the king, and that thou mightest know the thoughts of thine heart. So I like Daniel steps back and says, hey, king, I'm nothing special. I'm delivering. I'm just the messenger boy giving you this. You know, too many times Christians fall prey to that thing. Whoa, we're somebody. Preachers do that. You know, well, I'm somebody. I'm God's man. I'm the preacher. I'm God's anointed. You know, Daniel there had a message from heaven itself, and when he goes before the king to deliver it, says, hey, I'm just the messenger boy. It's not because I'm smart. It isn't because I'm intelligent and because I'm talented. I'm just here to deliver a message from God to you, and that's a way I think we ought to be. Let's see, verse 31. Thou, O king, sawest, and behold, a great image. Now, when it says image, we think of images, you know, like a picture, an image file on the internet or on our computer. Image in this case is in the biblical sense. This is a statue. Let's see, where was I? Verse 31, continuing. This great image, so a giant, think like, you know, Statue of Liberty or something, a giant statue, whose brightness was excellent, stood before thee, and the form thereof was terrible. Now, the word terrible there doesn't mean it was like a monster. It was just imposing and foreboding. I mean, you just looked up at this thing, and it just towered over you. I don't know if you've ever been up next to a giant building or a giant tower and just make you feel so small standing next to it from the scale. And I got a feeling that's kind of what the statue isn't horrible or scary or anything like that. But the word terrible there is basically just meaning that, I mean, it was so big, so imposing, it brought an emotional response. Verse 32, this image's head was of fine gold, his breast and his arms of silver, and his belly and his thighs of brass. Verse 33, his legs of iron, his feet part of iron and part of clay. So Daniel describes his statue. The head of the statue itself is made of gold. And then the area, the chest and arms, and the way most people illustrate this is the statue standing with, like, with its arms crossed across its chest. But the arms and the chest area are made of silver. And then kind of from the waist area down the upper parts of the legs are of brass. And then finally, the legs themselves are made of iron. And then when you get a little bit further down towards the feet, that iron is not just pure iron anymore. It's mixed with clay. Think of like pottery in that case. So that's a description of what this giant, huge image is made of, these four or five different sections, I guess you could say, if you want to count the iron and clay as a fifth one, but basically four different sections of gold, silver, brass, and iron, and as this statue is made up. Verse 34, Thou sawest till that a stone was cut out without hands, which smote the image upon his feet that were of iron and clay, and brake them to pieces. So as Nebuchadnezzar is seeing this giant statue, suddenly there comes down, rolling down the mountain, a stone. And no one pushed the stone. No one created the stone. The stone just was there. This stone had no beginning. The stone, basically comes from God himself, you could say. That's what's talking about. Was not cut out without hands. Means, nobody made this stone. It just comes out of nowhere. And hits the image down at the bottom, at its base, and those feet mixed with iron. And the statue just tumbles down and breaks. In verse 35, then was the iron, the clay, the brass, the silver, and the gold broken to pieces together and became like the chaff of the summer threshing floors. And the wind carried them away, that no place was found for them. And the stone that smote the image became a great mountain and filled the whole earth. So after the stone hits the statue is pulverized. It's atomized. It's disintegrated. It just turns to dust, and the wind just blows it away. And it's just atomized and seen no more. That's basically the chaff of the threshing floors. Was like when they would that threshing their wheat. They would take the wheat and beat it or throw it up in the air or something to separate the kernels from the other parts of the plant and the leaves and stuff around it. That was called the chaff. And the wind would blow it away. The force of the wind or the beating would help separate, and the wind would push away that lighter material away, and it would just blow off. And it was useless. It was no good. You didn't try to save it. It just blew away. You didn't care what happened to it. That's the illustration that's used there. Then that stone, that boulder, or however, it's kind of hard to describe. I don't know exactly what that it would look like. I kind of imagine a boulder. That boulder now sits instead of the statue, and that boulder begins to grow until that rock that smote the statue is now a huge mountain. And not just a giant mountain or a giant hill, but a mountain that would dwarf Mount Everest. In this mountain just dominates the entire world, the entire earth. And so that's the imagery that we see in this dream of this statue made of the many materials, of this stone that smites it and destroys it and then grows to dominate. Verse 36, this is the dream, and we will tell the interpretation thereof before the king. So here we go. What does all that mean? What is the statue? What is the stone? What does all this mean? Well, guess what? Daniel's going to tell us. Verse 37, thou, O king, he's talking to Nebuchadnezzar, art a king of kings, for the God of heaven hath given thee a kingdom, power, and strength, and glory. So, in verse 38, and wheresoever the children of men dwell, the beasts of the field, the fowls of the air, or the fowls of the heaven, hath he given into thine hand, and he hath made thee ruler over them all. Thou art this head of gold. So, first off, he says, Nebuchadnezzar, you are a powerful king, a king of kings. That you, even among kings, you excel above them. And that, you have all this power. That head of gold on that statue, that is you. That's Nebuchadnezzar. That is the, I'd call it the Babylonian Empire is represented. Nebuchadnezzar and his kingdom, that's that head of gold. Verse 39, and after thee shall rise another kingdom inferior to thee. That's the silver, the second kingdom that will arise and conquer Babylon. And that second kingdom historically, we'll just go into this. Babylon itself, the first kingdom, the head of gold, about 605 to 539 BC is kind of a date range for that. Just to give you an understanding of the time frame. It was very short, about 70, almost 70 years that Babylon was the great world power. So that's the head of gold. The second kingdom, verse 39, this another kingdom inferior to thee, lesser, as silver is lesser than gold, inferior to gold. Doesn't mean it's just trash. It just means it's not as good. The second kingdom is powerful, but it just lacks something of the majesty and the intrigue and the power of Babylon. The second kingdom is the kingdom of Persia, which lasts from about 539 to 331 BC. Continuing on in verse 39. And another third kingdom of brass, which shall bear rule over all the earth. This kingdom of brass, we see, you know, now it's not even as good as silver. You see, this stuff's kind of getting more common, less valuable as we go down. But the third kingdom of brass in the statue represents the Greek Empire, which is about 331 to 168. It's kind of hard to get an ending date on that, but basically it talks about bear rule over all the earth. Well, you know who that was? Alexander the Great, one of our favorite people to talk about. It seems like he comes up all the time because he changed the world. You know? But thanks to him, the Greek power and influence, you know, spread throughout the world. He conquers much of the, you know, the world right there, quote unquote. I mean, not the entire globe, but so much of the world as the people of the area there thought. So that third kingdom, that's the Greek Empire. In verse 40, and the fourth kingdom shall be strong as iron, for as much as iron breaketh in pieces and subdueth all things, and as iron that breaketh all these shall it break in pieces and bruise. The fourth kingdom, the kingdom of iron, represents Rome. And Rome in about 168 BC is when they conquered Greece, the mainland, or I don't remember exactly what that date is, what battle or anything that is, but that's when Rome comes onto the scene. And then we're familiar with Rome and the Caesars and the, you know, the Republic and how that goes on for centuries. You know, and even today, their influence is still felt. That is the fourth kingdom. It talks about the might and the power, because Rome in its heyday, no one stood against Rome. Rome just, you know, would go in and conquer. And if you beat Rome, they came back and came back and came back and came back until they beat you. That's the way Rome, at the height of its power, operated. So verse 41. And whereas thou sawest the feet and toes, part of potter's clay and part of iron, the kingdom shall be divided. And there shall be in it of the strength of iron, forasmuch as thou sawest the iron mixed with miry clay. Verse 42, and as the toes of the feet was part of iron and part of clay, so the kingdom shall be partly strong and partly broken. So this is kind of like the end results of the Roman Empire. Of course, we know studying history that, you know, the Roman Empire split into Eastern and Western halves. And let's see, was it the Eastern half was the one that was conquered? No, Western half. Oh my goodness, I can't believe I've gone blank on that. But anyway, you know, eventually, you know, it's all conquered and whittled down until it's divided. But it's funny, even some of the borders and terminology and things today are all rooted back into the Roman Empire. Even money, to a large extent, even our money. A lot of our terms, you can trace them back through various languages and various, you know, etymology and different things, and they trace back to Roman terms. Pound, the word, you know, the word pound, we abbreviate that LB. LB is a Latin abbreviation. It's a Roman term. I think it's Libra, if I remember correctly. But, I mean, there's just so much. The power of Rome, even though there is no Caesar, even though there is, you know, Rome itself, though it's still a great city, has a lot of power through the Roman Catholic Church and different things like that, you know, it's not the empire that it once was, but there's still little parts of it still existing. I think that's kind of what that's talking about, that's mixed. It's not powerful, it's mixed. Part of iron, some of the old Roman Empire is still there, but it's mixed with something else, something base. And one commentator I read said that is a sign that you know, this is the strength of the monarchy mixed with democracy, and you have this mixing of various forms of government or aristocracy and common people mixing. But you know, whatever it is, this mixing of things that really shouldn't mix is taking place, and it's not as strong as it once was. It's really a shadow of its former self at this point. And verse 43, it says, yeah, and whereas thou sawest iron mixed with miry clay, they shall mingle themselves with the seed of men, but they shall not cleave one to another, even as iron is not mixed with clay. So that's what I'm talking about, this kind of mixture of things going on. You know, clay and iron don't naturally mix together. Certain metals you can mix and make alloys. Clay and iron, you can't do that. You know, you can, you know, set clay in iron fittings and different things like that. But these two, just you just don't mix these two. It doesn't work. They're not compatible. Verse 44. Oh, and it talks about in verse 43 that they shall not cleave one to another. This means, you know, there's not a lot of unity. And whatever this final form of the Roman government is, of the Roman Empire that we see, that there's not unity. There's a lot of division and strife and fighting amongst itself. You know, sounds kind of like a democracy, doesn't it? But this could be, for instance, if we trace this all the way back, some of the imagery of Daniel, of course, pops back up in Revelation. Well, Revelation talks about the there being 10 kings at the time dealing with the Antichrist. Well, you think toes, or how many toes? There's 10 toes. So is this a illustration of things, you know, a connection there? And those 10 kings are really the last vestige of the Roman Empire, some type of alliance or coalition. Some people say, you know, the European Union or something like that. But you have these 10 kings, what the Roman Empire has finally, you know, branched out and become, just a shadow of its former self, not strong, not united, and bickering amongst itself. You know, that's kind of what we see there. And this, when I'm talking about this, this is end times kind of stuff. We're talking about stuff that hasn't happened yet, that probably, you know, I believe is probably happening right now. Could really kind of figure all this out, and probably when we get to heaven or after it all is fulfilled, you know, we'll look back and say, oh, well, yeah, duh, now I see it. But I think this is kind of stuff that you're talking about will happen in the tribulation period, with the iron mixed with clay. Okay, why do I know that? Because verse 44, and in the days of these kings, so there's a specific time in the days that's coming of those kings that are part iron, part clay, that are not cleaving one to another, shall the God of heaven set up a kingdom. Now, what kingdom is that? Huh? That's the kingdom of God. That's the kingdom of Christ. That's the millennial kingdom that's being referenced there, which shall never be destroyed, and the kingdom shall not be left to other people, but it shall break in pieces and consume all these kingdoms, and it shall stand forever. That's the kingdom of God coming. Now, is that the church? No, it's not. The church is never commanded to conquer. The church is never commanded to rule. You know, the church is commanded to spread the gospel. The church is commanded to, in certain cases, you know, to help. The church is commanded to band together for the unified benefit of one another. The church is commanded to preserve the doctrines and preserve the teachings of Christ. The church is nowhere in the Bible commanded to conquer. This is not talking about the church. There was a lot of misinterpretation of the scriptures in times past and even today, where people thought, you know, the world will get so good and the Christians will take over, and eventually the world will get so good and so Christianized that God comes back. That's not how prophecy outlines things. Prophecy outlines things that things are going to get so terrible it takes God coming back to straighten things out. Is more like the prophetic picture that we have. So what this is talking about, this kingdom, this that's represented by the stone not made with hands that crushes those human empires, that stone is representing something, not the church, and probably not even, I hesitate to even say millennial kingdom. I think this is a broader term, where this is God's kingdom, and this is God ruling. It talks about, you know, once that's come, it never be destroyed, won't be left to other people. You know, this kingdom lasts forever. No one takes over this kingdom. Once this kingdom comes in, you know, it's it forever and ever and ever more. So when in the prophetic timeline do we see that happening? Well, probably in the millennial kingdom, you know, minus the little revolt kind of at the end of that and then going into the eternal state, you know, but that's kind of the time period we're talking about. This is a promise that's coming, that at the end of all this, all these human empires will fall before God and before God's power, and God himself shall rule and reign over eternity. Let's see, boy, where am I at? Verse 45. For as much as thou sawest that the stone was cut out of the mountain without hands, and that it break the pieces, break in pieces the iron, the brass, the clay, the silver, and the gold, the great God hath made known to thee, king, to the king, what shall come to pass hereafter, and the dream is certain, and the interpretation thereof sure. So he closed out saying, look, you know, that stone not made with hands, that I mean, this is God's working coming to break that series of human government, of human empires. This thing is sure. I like it that God has made known to you what's going to happen. You know, the God, this is God telling you, king, who's kind of the fountainhead and the pinnacle and the beginning of all of this, that he's revealing to you what's going to happen. And then I like this, the dream is certain. You know, what God showed you is going to happen. It's as, you know, sure as the sun rising and setting. This, you know, the most sure thing in the world is what God says. God said this is going to happen. It will happen. And the interpretation thereof is sure. I like that. It's not just, well, the dream and the statue and everything. Daniel says, no, what I told you in telling you what this meant is sure, it's certain as the dream. So in this dream that God gave Nebuchadnezzar, he gives this prophetic outline of human history. Now, I kind of just jumped in there and just told you, hey, this is what this represents. That's pretty well established in conservative theology from what I can tell. I couldn't really see any other interpretations of that I could find. So I don't really know that I can give you another case. It's pretty well accepted that this is talking about this series of empires. And this is something that we will see again in chapter 7. So, anyway, and when I get the notes up, I don't have them up yet. Maybe by the time I release this, I will. I actually have a nice little drawing I drew of a, you know, statue, and it's really pathetic, and kind of outlining, you know, what this may have looked like, and you know, what the pieces and everything were, with some of the dates and everything that are coming. If you look it up on Google, there's a bunch of great illustrations of this, way better than what I drew. I just couldn't find one I liked, so I drew my own. And it looks like I drew him out. So anyway, all right, verse 46. Then the king Nebuchadnezzar fell upon his face and worshipped Daniel and commanded that they should offer an oblation and sweet odors unto him. So Nebuchadnezzar is so excited, he worships Daniel. Is that supposed to be what happens? No. But, you know, Daniel, can he stop the king from doing it? Probably not. You know, nowhere does it say Daniel went along with this. But fell on his face and worshipped him. Oblation is like a drink offering, pouring out something for him. Sweet odors, offering incense. I mean, they're making a big deal about Daniel. Because, I mean, hey, Daniel just did the impossible. Well, God used Daniel to reveal the impossible. But, I mean, what Daniel just told him was impossible to know. He knew a dream that the king himself couldn't even remember. And the interpretation of that dream that the king himself couldn't even remember. So, verse 47, the king answered unto Daniel and said, of a truth it is that your God is a God of gods and a Lord of kings and a revealer of secrets, seeing that thou couldest reveal this secret. Now, like this, you know, when Daniel walks in, remember Daniel's friends took a stand for their Jewish faith, for their Jewish identity in chapter number 1. Well, here we see that, you know, they're still, it's not, hey, boy, great, you're another magician, Chaldean, you're another scientist, you're another magician, or whatever, you know, the terms that they were using. You know, he knows this guy is a Jew. Now, he is one of these Chaldeans, he's one of this upper class, elite scholars, smart people, but still, he knows this guy is a Jew, this guy worships a different God than I do. There's, that is still obvious with Daniel as talking to him, maybe his appearance and his actions, even what he said. I mean, he had made a big deal about it in this speech, but it's obvious. He hadn't mentioned the gods of Babylon, Marduk and the others. But like this, he said, your God is a God of gods. So, I mean, not only does he honor Daniel, but he said, hey, that God you serve, boy, he must be a powerful God among the gods. He is super powerful. He stands out among the gods. And that, you know, he's a Lord of kings, that he has power over rulers. Now, it's interesting, and we'll get into this a little bit later. We'll see Nebuchadnezzar kind of develop a better respect and better understanding of who God is. And what he's saying right here, oh, this is nice, but he's not saved. He's not a Christian or a Jew or anything right here. He's just saying, hey, that God you serve, hey, all the gods I serve, yeah, he's as powerful as the best of ours. You know, he's still, polytheism is still all through all this. But these powers, you know, this is the polytheistic mind, you know, they say, well, this power belongs to this certain God. So what does he say the powers of this Jewish God are? Well, you know, he has power over kings and revealing secrets. You know, it's like, well, that's the God of revealing secrets and setting up kings. So that's kind of what he's saying right there in so many words. Verse 48, then the king made Daniel a great man and gave him many great gifts and made him ruler of the whole province of Babylon and chief of the governors of over all the wise men of Babylon. So part of the reward and probably just part of it, just recognizing the talent and the person of Daniel, he establishes Daniel as a major player. Now, remember, he's still probably just a teenager at this point. You know, maybe mid to late teens, probably late teens, probably not 20 years old. But because of this, he's a great man. He's a powerful man. I've been giving him many gifts. So now, you know, he's got some wealth. He has some power. And what he's done, the kingdom of Babylon, the empire of Babylon, was split into different provinces. Think, you know, like we do with counties and states, you know, subdivide a larger area into smaller ruling districts. Well, in this case, there was a province of Babylon, the area surrounding the city of Babylon. And it's the number one most important area. It's where the capital is, where the palace is, where the king is. So who is in charge of the most important, most powerful, richest, you know, province in the Empire of Babylon? Why, it's Daniel. Daniel is now the most powerful of all the governors. In fact, it says, you know, he's the chief of the governors over all the wise men of Babylon. Not only is he over the province of Babylon, he's over all those smart people that have been training him for the last few years. You know, all those Chaldeans and magicians and astrologers and all that kind of stuff. Who's the number one guy? It's now Daniel. Daniel has gone from being, you know, the poor Hebrew captive to now being one of the most powerful men in the kingdom. Just overnight, basically, in revealing this dream. In verse 49, we'll wrap up the chapter. Then Daniel requested of the king, and he set Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego over the affairs of the province of Babylon, but Daniel sat in the gate before of the king. So what does Daniel do? The first thing he does, hey, I got some friends. Can they help me? They're really good guys. And, you know, Nebuchadnezzar's like, well, Daniel, wow, you know, you're in charge. You can do what you want, man. So what does he do? He brings up, and he doesn't forget his friends. Now that he's got, you know, this power and this authority and this prestige, he doesn't forget those people who've come along with him. I kind of like that about Daniel. There's so much about his character that I love. But he goes and he elevates his friends alongside them and makes them kind of his sub-governors, you know, assistant governors underneath him over the province of Babylon. And what he does is he lets them basically run the province. He puts them in charge. Even though Daniel holds the title and is the ultimate authority, the actual running of the province, he leaves to these to his friends. So now they're over the most powerful province and area in the Babylonian Empire. And what does Daniel do? Daniel, it says, sat in the gate of the king, that Daniel stays at the palace, that Daniel stays, you know, in around the throne, that Daniel stays around the king. That shows, you know, that his place isn't just in a province. His place is a very powerful advisor. That's probably the role I would describe it as. He's an advisor. I won't say the term vizier, but that probably doesn't really fit very well. But, you know, he is the number one advisor to the king and one of the most powerful men politically now in the Empire of Babylon. And that is the story, Daniel chapter 2, of the great image, of the great statue that Nebuchadnezzar dreamed of. Now, let me look through my notes real quick, see if there's anything else that I wanted to say. Let me wrap up. Let me tie this in a little bit more. We'll go back to the kingdom. I've got a few notes that talk about with the Roman Empire in the end times. The kingdom of Christ is going to destroy it. That hasn't happened. So we know that whatever happens is going to happen in the future. I talked a little bit about that. I talked about the two legs, you know, the divisions, 2 feet, 10 toes. There's a division of power marked by strength and weakness. That's clearly described as being the final empire, because after it's defeated, no one ever defeats, you know, the God's kingdom falling after it. The references, if you want to, when I told about the 10 toes and 10 kings, chapter 2, verses 42 through 44. Also look at Daniel chapter 7, verse 24. And then Revelation chapter 17, verse 12 talks about the 10 kings and kind of tie all that back together. So I guess I did cover most of that. I wasn't sure if I covered everything. But there you go. I think that does a pretty good job of covering the chapter and giving you a good idea. I hate kind of rushing through all the history and the prophecy there. Even though we've gone almost an hour in this lesson, I still feel like I rushed way too fast through that. Part of that's for time. Part of it is because, you know, even it's just a few verses there, you know, describing the statue and everything. But there's so much more. We'll get to revisit it, you know. Luckily, we'll get to revisit it in Daniel chapter 7, but there's so much there. You can study out the history of in this line of kingdoms. And one other thing I want to mention is that these kingdoms, you know, comparatively, you know, today we think of the great empires and we'll think of Rome. We may think of Greece. We may think of like China and, you know, different things even past this time period. We may think of the Mongols or the Russians or the British or the French or something like that, the Spanish. Well, why these four kingdoms? It's because they center around Israel. These kingdoms, this line of kingdoms, are a line of kingdoms that ruled over and controlled Israel. Because Israel is the centerpiece of prophecy. Not America, not Britain. The centerpiece of prophecy is Israel. Everything centers around Israel when it comes to prophecy. So don't get sidetracked into thinking, you know, things that happen in America are signs of the end times. Maybe a little bit, but focus on Israel. Israel is the key. It's the epicenter of prophecy. So these four kingdoms all center around their control of Israel. It's not that these were the maybe even the four greatest kingdoms. I think Rome probably was the greatest empire of history. But I mean, there have been powerful empires. Even America now, in an imperial sense, I mean, controls and has a lot of great influence throughout the world. But you know, all these things, all of these revolve around their control of Israel. So I just wanted to throw that in there too. Now, looks like I got everything else. I was just reading the verses going off the top of my head. I get excited. I wasn't even looking at the notes. So anyway, there you go. Daniel chapter 2. I hope that was a help and a blessing to you, that help you understand the chapter a little bit and the prophecy. In fact, in my brand new Bible, my brand new wide margin Bible, I actually went ahead next to verses 38 and 39. I actually put the little outline of those kingdoms, you know, 1, Babylon, 2, Persia, 3, Greece, 4, Rome, and some dates beside them. So even though I know it off the top of my head, it's pretty easy to remember, especially, you know, if you study the history and stuff. But I just want to make sure I don't forget and put that in there. So anyway, next time, chapter 3, we'll get to deal with the fiery furnace. Woohoo! another great Sunday school story. Can't wait to get into that and talk a little bit about that. So anyway, I appreciate you listening today. Check out BaptistBasics.org for other resources. I will try my best to get on it and get some more of these lessons out and recorded. I am so enjoying studying this and been teaching it in Sunday school. And I really, honestly, I can't wait to get this stuff recorded and on the website. So I hope it's a help and a blessing to you. Thank you for listening. I'm Matthew Gage. I will see you next time.